Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we are talking about Anna Karenina, part 1, chapter 3, and then we'll read chapter 4. The thing about selling off the forest, can anyone clarify that? He chose a political affiliation based on popular opinion. What are your thoughts on that? And good dad or bad dad? Sluggy said, I just wanted to highlight this passage that I loved when Steva asks his daughter if her mother is cheerful. The girl knew that this is from the Bartlett translation, by the way. The girl knew that there had been a quarrel between her father and mother, and that her mother could not be cheerful, that her father ought to know this, and that he was putting on an act in asking about it so breezily, and she blushed for her father. He immediately understood this and blushed as well. I love how his daughter intuits all of this from his question and reacts, and then he in turn understands this and reacts to her thoughts despite no words passing between them. Little Birdie 8612 said, you pointed out a lot of good things here. Blushing is a very prevalent motive in the book. It's supposed to symbolize unbidden emotion, which one can call the root of all conflicts in the novel, having feelings you know you shouldn't have and the struggle between embracing and repressing it. This subverbal communication is also a really important theme. I guess you can say that two people who are capable of this kind of understanding of each other are kindred spirits, and you can easily judge if they're in a good relationship by whether or not they can achieve subverbal communication, at least in this book. Oblonsky did not choose his politics or opinions, but these seemed to come to him from their own accord, just as he did not change the style of his hat or coat, but always wore those that were in fashion. Little Birdie pointed out this one line here. Oblonsky's political opinions are as superficial and thoughtless as his choice of hat or coat, mere accessories to adorn his public reputation and appearance. His political opinions, and probably his moral principles too, are only defined by what is immediately convenient to him, and thus there is nothing constant or steady in his character. This fits perfectly with the way his loyalty to his wife was so easy to sway when the governess came along. But again, much of Russian society in the Victorian era was guilty of succumbing to societal principles and keeping up appearances. This superficial quality in Oblonsky also ties in with the way he interacts with his children. Tolstoy gives an interesting amount of importance to the language he makes his characters speak. But this is probably more evident later in the novel. Tolstoy was a Russian through and through and thought that making children speak European language like English and French to be educated wasn't necessary. In a sense, these people were behaving and forming judgments based on social principles rather than emotional values, just like Oblonsky. So when Tanya, his favorite daughter, says, I told you you can't put passengers on the roof in English, Tolstoy explicitly specifies this, it seems fitting that both father and daughter appeal to each other. This is not to say that Oblonsky likes his daughter, but because she speaks English, I think it's just an interesting symbolic subtle detail that Tolstoy uses to further characterize Oblonsky. Both Tanya and Grisha seem to have some idea that something happened between their parents, but only Tanya is able to keep up appearances and show affection for her father, while Grisha remains aloof. Even Oblonsky's love toward his children seems a bit superficial. He was aware that he did not care as much for the boy as for the girl, and he always tried to treat them in the same way. He cares for his children because he knows that a father is supposed to, even if he doesn't, thus only keeping up appearances before the public. He even feels the need to pretend in front of the children. His children know that their father must have done something wrong, and Oblonsky endeavors to still act as the good dad by giving them sweets. Oh yeah. Oblonsky is superficial at mind and at heart. Great analysis, said Syntax Approval. Also, I totally missed the point of that his daughter had said that in English. Thanks for pointing that out. Swim said the mum of fishy said, question one. What was question one? Sorry. Oh, about selling off the forest. And can anyone clarify that plot point? Excuse me. Can anyone clarify that plot point? Swim said the mum of fishy said, it is significant that the term selling forests rather than selling land is used. Wood was a lucrative commodity in 19th century Russia. It is still, by the way. Russia has significant forest reserves compared to the rest of the world, and therefore a very important resource to own. The brothers Karamazov use the selling of forest as a plot point. It appears that Stephen needs to sell his wife's estate forest to fund his overextended lifestyle. So in addition to turning his wife into a broodmare and household drudge, he was also a gold digger as well. Question two was about his political affiliations. Swim said the bumfish. He said, Steva is a very shallow man. And compared to Fyodor Karamazov in The Brothers Karamazov, he is father of the year. Steva's son sees right through his joviality and superficial bonhomie. I'm glad at least someone in the household has Steva's number. Somastar says, as I understood it, his wife has an estate, likely inherited, that involves a large chunk of land. Someone wants to buy some of the land, a section of woods, that is on the estate. Stepan wants / needs to be involved negotiating the sale because in this era, a woman's money was never her own. The money will go to him, so he has an interest in making sure the sale is a profitable one for him. He feels he can't discuss this sale with her until they are reconciled, and he is uncomfortable knowing he may be forced to reconcile with her simply because he needs to be involved in the sale. Best case interpretation, he feels guilty that the sale, rather than love, is what is going to drive a reconciliation with his wife. Worst case, he doesn't really desire reconciliation and resents that the sale will force him to reconcile with his wife. It's not really clear which interpretation is how he's feeling. You know, I don't know about that, about what was that bit about them? In this era, a woman's money was never her own. The money will go to him. I don't know if that's strictly true. I'm only judging this based on War and Peace and, to a lesser extent, The Brothers Karamazov. But what I gathered in War and Peace was that that Russian society back at that time didn't really have that the male was the absolute dominator of the household kind of thing. Like, you see that with Italian families in that kind of era, and but probably a lot of cultures where it's like very much the father runs the money for the house. But I never really got that sense with the Russian stories, or in the sort of 1800s Russian stories. There's a lot of examples of, well, I suppose, yeah, I don't know, actually. Now that's other, because I'm remembering a scene in War and Peace where Rostov, the wife, has to ask her husband to cut her a check for some money. But, well, not a check. Well, she asked for some money. So maybe he does control. Oh, I don't know. Anyway, I never got the impression from that like, it was like a really kind of patriarchal family structure. But maybe I just got that wrong. Sluggy said, this is the gist of it, although interestingly, noble women in Russia at this time had greater property rights than their contemporaries in Europe and could own and sell their own property even while married, stemming from a decree in 1753. The exact circumstances of Darya's land are not clear here, but at the very least it seems it would be inconvenient or improper for Steva to sell the land without having her involved. Oh, okay, well, there's one bit about it. Oh, it's more specifically about their property rights, but yeah, I don't know. A few, so far in the discussion of Anna Karenina, there's been a few moments where it's kind of like been saying how oppressive it was for the women in these households, but I don't really know. I mean, maybe. I think it was probably oppressive for a lot of people. It's probably just an oppressive time to live in general. But I don't know. I never got the sense reading the other books that it was like hugely oppressive to women. Where some of the conversation so far has kind of like leaned that way. Like it was a terrible time to be a woman in that time and place. I don't know. I'd like to see some more conversation about that to get some more opinions. I'm only basing this on War and Peace, so I'm no expert. Captain Lush said, I think it's clear that Steva does not want reconciliation with his wife because nothing could come out of it but deceit and lies. And deceit and lies were contrary to his nature. Also, Steve agrees with the Liberals that marriage is an obsolete institution that gives Steve a little satisfaction and obliges him to lie and pretend, which is contrary to his nature. So, if there is any reason why Steve is going to Dolly for reconciliation, it's only for the sale, and Steve regrets this because it means more lying and pretending, which is contrary to his nature. I think it's safe to assume that if the land was not an issue, Steve would not be going to Dolly for reconciliation. Peril Bull Finch said, I think about selling off the forest. Not sure what this question means. His wife owns a forest that he wants to sell because he needs money. I'm assuming his wife would be reluctant to sell it because it means she would own less land. If Steve's debts are from spending on himself rather than his family, she might be even more reluctant. Yeah, well, that's all the question meant. Like, I think it seemed like a plot point that might be important, and just in case anyone like lacked clarity about the sale, like why did he want the sale, who didn't want the sale, kind of things. I think sometimes it's just cool to just grab a little plot point that happens that maybe some people didn't quite wrap their heads around, and just make sure everyone's on the same page with it. Yula is a pimp said, I think enough people have talked about the forest, but I just want to add that it really builds Steve's indifference in relation to his wife further. It upsets him that he may try to seek reconciliation. He doesn't want to make things right with his wife, except that it is becoming inconvenient to not do so, and he doesn't care what she is going through. I thought the description of his interest in the newspaper was rather funny. It had a very modern feel to it, just further reinforces that Steve appears at this point to be rather self-serving and vapid. And I don't know how much would have been expected of an upper-class Russian man at that time, but honestly, I'm not sure it matters. He is a bad father. His indifference is expressed in Chapter 2, even though he has a nice enough interaction with his favourite child. Here it comes as he simultaneously ignores another. He claims he tries with the boy, but it really kind of given away in the language. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I thought he did an okay job. I mean, there's some drama going down, and he kind of tried to make things lighthearted with his kids and not really make a fuss among them. And I liked the way that he wasn't, I mean, I didn't think he was particularly dismissive, but he just wasn't like, I don't know, what would you say? He didn't make a fuss, which sometimes is like the best thing you can do with kids when there's a drama going down. I Am Norwegian said, in my translation, it simply said the woods. I just assumed they had timber or firewood to sell, but his wife owns it, so he needs to go through her to finish the deal. I think Stepan is a good-natured person, but not a good person. His daughters seem to love him. Sorry, his daughter seems to love him, but the fact that his youngest son is aware that he's playing favourites is not a good sign. Altreet said, I love this distinction. He's a good-natured person, but not a good person. Many people can be cheerful and outgoing and make people feel good about themselves through conferring attention, but this does not mean they are upright or trustworthy or moral or otherwise good. Yeah, very much so. And vice versa. It's a very interesting distinction to make, and I've never really made that distinction. So, thanks. I Am Norwegian. Nimax said, is anyone else getting the feeling that Oblonsky is very unemotional? He seems to look at things very objectively. For example, with the selling of the forest. Chineering said, I don't think he's unemotional. I just think that he's good nature and fortune. It's just that thanks to his good nature and fortune, nothing has ever really gone wrong for him. And as a result, he approaches everything without much worry. Techrific said, the thing about the selling off the forest, it introduced a further complication into the present situation. Apparently the wood has to be sold for money problems, but the fact that it belongs to his wife's estate is distressing since they've not reconciled yet, if ever. In all probability, he hesitates to bring financial discussions into the present problem in order to not aggravate the situation further. It could give off the wrong impression about priorities to his already distressed wife. He also seems to resent the fact his motive for seeking reconciliation could be construed as an economic one. Guanadal said, I enjoyed the mention of Steve eating kalach with his coffee. My Czech grandmother used to make what she called kalaches, pastries like cookies with a jelly filling. I wonder how similar they are. Captain Lush said in the Joel Carmichael translation, it says he ate a buttered roll with his coffee. Yep, same in the Maud one. It looks like the Garnet one did as well. But either way, yeah, it sounded pretty good. A buttered roll with a coffee. Is there anything better than just bread and butter? I mean, honestly, it's just the best. Oh, I'm hungry now. Lemike91 said, it really seems that Steve is doing what the society wants him to do, It really seems that Steve is doing what the society wants him to do, what is right for a man of that time, not what he really wants. So having a family is not his first priority. It brings only problems, reconciliation with his wife. I think that relations with parents were different at that time, specifically father-son relationships, so I don't know if we can call him a good or a bad dad. I guess even nowadays parents have favoritism. Dr. 96 said, regardless of where the proceeds of the sale would go, the money from the sale might influence their willingness to reconcile. This worries Steve because then the reconciliation would not be authentic. I think this is fine until he starts to adopt harmful opinions. Oh, sorry, this is answering the next question about him getting his opinions from newspapers. I think this is fine until he starts to adopt harmful opinions. It's good if he's learning good thoughts, but bad if he's blindly adopting bad thoughts. Yeah, okay, I suppose you could say that, but then who defines what are the good things he's learning or the bad ones if they're just coming from popular opinion anyway? Well, if they're the popular opinion, even if they are a good thought, more people believe that good thought, bad thought. Oh my God, what am I trying to say? You know what I mean. And the third question, Dr. Nature96 said, he's a bad dad. He's just doing the minimum. On the other hand, at least he's not a tyrant, so relatively good. He treats his daughter well, but is unfair to his son. Not a rare thing, but he should also be good to his son, especially since his son notices it. Good boy. Keeping my comments short today. Really curious now to the point it distracts me from reading The Idiot, but I like this one chapter per day structure. Oh, I'm glad you like it. I like it too. I don't know. I'm not ready to say he's a bad dad. I mean, he had, that one little interaction with his son, he wasn't particularly, great. Didn't really do anything great. And the son felt like he wasn't the favorite. But, I mean, you've got two siblings. One of them is always going to feel like they're not the favorite. I think that's just going to happen. And I don't think he made either of them feel bad. And I actually thought he did quite a good job of, downplaying the drama that was going on. So, that's my two cents. I'm not ready to say bad dad just yet. Not just yet. I also think maybe, I've got this feeling that maybe the mother, whose name I can't remember at this second, might be a bit kind of neurotic or dramatic, maybe you could say. And I'm just completely guessing this, but I'm just basing it on how people are siding with him, even though they're closer with her, and how they want things reconciled. And the fact that everyone really wants it reconciled makes it seem like it's quite dramatic, but then from his point, it doesn't really seem like he's being dramatic about it at all. It seems quite the opposite. So I'm thinking, well, if it's dramatic enough that it's bothering the rest of the household, then maybe all that is coming from the other side. Although he did have an affair, so she has a pretty legitimate reason to be dramatic. But, I don't know. What am I saying? Yeah, maybe him as a father just downplaying the seriousness of it and trying not to fuss. Maybe that's a good move. All right, anyway, I don't really know. I don't know. I got no idea. Ah, gosh. should we just keep reading? Because I'm just guessing, really. I'm just guessing. I like this guy. I like this main character, even though he's in the doghouse and he's done a very awful thing. But he's likable. And I don't know, he's the first character I meet. I've got this thing, whenever you meet the first character in the book, you always want them to be the main character, don't you? Or is that just me? I'm just oh, this is the main guy. Okay, I can side with him. I could be wrong. All right, let's read chapter 4. It goes like this. Daya Alexandrovna was there in a dressing jacket with her large frightened eyes, made more prominent by the emaciation of her face and her knot of thin plaits of once luxurious and beautiful hair. The room was covered with scattered articles, and she was standing among them before an open wardrobe, where she was engaged in selecting something. Hearing her husband's step, she stopped and looked at the door, vainly trying to assume a severe and contemptuous expression. She felt that she was afraid of him and afraid of the impending interview. She was trying to do what she had attempted 10 times already during those 3 days, to sort out her own and her children's clothes to take to her mother's, but she could not bring herself to do it, and said again, as she had done after each previous attempt, that things could not remain as they were, that she must do something to punish and humiliate him, and to revenge herself if only for a small part of the pain he had caused her. Still, she kept saying that she would leave him, but felt that this was impossible. It was impossible because she could not get out of the habit of regarding him as her husband and of loving him. Besides, she felt that if here in her own home, it was all she could do to look after her 5 children properly, it would be still worse where she meant to take them. As it was, during these 3 days, the youngest had fallen ill because they had given him sour broth, and the others had had hardly any dinner yesterday. She felt that it was impossible for her to leave, but still deceiving herself, she went on sorting the things and pretending that she really would go. On seeing her husband, she thrust her arms into a drawer of the wardrobe as if looking for something, and only when he had come close to her did she turn her face toward him. But her face, which she wanted to seem stern and determined, expressed only perplexity and suffering. "Dolly," he said in a soft, timid voice. He drew his head down, wishing to look pathetic and submissive, but all the same he shone with freshness and health. With a rapid glance she took in his fresh and healthy figure, from head to foot. "Yes, he is happy and contented," she thought. "But what about me? And that horrid good nature of his, which people love and praise so, how I hate it." She pressed her lips together and a cheek muscle twitched on the right side of her pale and nervous face. "What do you want?" she said quickly, with a voice unlike her usual deep tones. "Dolly," he repeated unsteadily, "Anna is coming today." "What's that to do with me? I can't receive her," she exclaimed. "But after all, Dolly, you really must," said he. "Go away, go away, go away," she cried, as if in physical pain, without looking at him. Oblonsky could think calmly of his wife, could hope that things would shape themselves, as Matthew had said, and could calmly read his paper and drink his coffee, but when he saw her worn, suffering face and heard her tone, resigned and despairing, he felt a choking sensation. A lump rose in his throat and tears glistened in his eyes. "Oh my God, what have I done? Dolly, for heaven's sake, you know..." He could not continue. His throat was choked with sobs. She slammed the doors of the wardrobe and looked up at him. "Dolly, what can I say? Only forgive me. Think, 9 years. Can't they atone for a momentary? Her eyes drooped and she waited to hear what he would say, as if entreating him to persuade her somehow that she had made a mistake. "A momentary infatuation," he said, and was going on, but at those words her lips tightened again as if with pain, and again the muscle in her right cheek began to twitch. Go away from here," she cried in a still shriller voice, "and don't talk to me of your infatuations and all those horrors." She wished to go away, but staggered and held on to the back of the chair to support herself. His face broadened, his lips swelled, and his eyes filled with tears. "Dolly," he said, now actually sobbing, "for heaven's sake, think of the children. They have done nothing. Punish me, make me suffer for my sin. Tell me what to do. I am ready for anything. I am the guilty one. I have no words to express my guilt, but Dolly, forgive me." She sat down and he could hear her loud, heavy breathing. He felt unutterably sorry for her. She tried again and again to speak and could not. He waited. You think about children when you want to play with them, but I am always thinking of them, and no, they are ruined now, she said, evidently repeating one of the phrases she had used to herself again and again during those 3 days. But she had spoken of our children, and looking gratefully at her, he moved to take her hand, but she stepped aside with a look of repugnance. I do think of the children, and would do anything in the world to save them, but I do not know how to save them, whether by taking them away from their father or by leaving them with a dissolute, yes, dissolute father. Tell me, do you think it's possible for us to live together after what has happened? Is it possible? Say, is it possible? She repeated, raising her voice. When my husband, the father of my children, has love affairs with his children's governess? But what's to be done? What's to be done? Said he, in a piteous voice, hardly knowing what he was saying, and sinking his head lower and lower. You are horrid and disgusting to me, she shouted, getting more and more excited. Your tears are water. You never loved me. You have no heart, no honour. To me, you are detestable, disgusting, a stranger, yes, a perfect stranger. She uttered the word stranger, so terrible to herself, with anguish and hatred. He looked at her, and the hatred he saw in her face frightened and surprised him. He did not understand that his pity exasperated her. She saw in him pity for herself, but not love. No, she hates me. She will not forgive me, he thought. It is awful, awful, he muttered. At that moment, a child began to cry in another room, probably having tumbled down. Darya Alexandrovna listened, and her face softened suddenly. She seemed to be trying to recollect herself, as if she did not know where she was or what she had to do. Then she rose quickly and moved toward the door. After all, she loves my child, he thought, noticing the change in her face when the baby cried. My child, then how can she hate me? Dolly, just a word, he said, following her. If you follow me, I shall call the servants and the children. I'll let everybody know you are a scoundrel. I am going away today, and you may live here with your mistress. She went out, slamming the door. Oblonsky sighed, wiped his face, and with soft steps left the room. Matthew says things will shape themselves. But how? I don't even see a possibility. Oh dear, the horror of it. And her shouting, it was so vulgar, he thought, recalling her screams and the words scoundrel and mistress. And the maids may have heard it. It is dreadfully banal, dreadfully. For a few seconds, Oblonsky stood alone, then he wiped his eyes, sighed, and expanding his chest, went out of the room. It was a Friday, the day of which a German clockmaker always came to wind up the clock. The clocks. Seeing him in the dining room, Oblonsky recollected a joke he had once made at the expense of this accurate, bald-headed clockmaker, and he smiled. The German, he had said, has been wound up for life to wind up clocks. Oblonsky was fond of a joke. Well, perhaps things will shape themselves. Shape themselves. That's a good phrase, he thought. I must use that. Matthew, he called, will you and Mary arrange everything for Anna Arkadyevna in the little sitting room, he added when Matthew appeared. Yes, sir. Oblonsky put on his fur coat and went out into the porch. Will you be home to dinner, sir? Said Matthew as he showed him out. I'll see. Oh, here's some money, he said, he taking a 10-ruble note out of his pocketbook. Will it be enough? Enough or not, we shall have to manage, that's clear, said Matthew, closing the carriage door and stepping back into the porch. Meanwhile, Darya Alexandrovna, after soothing the child, knowing from the sound of the carriage wheels that her husband had gone, returned to her bedroom. It was her only place of refuge from household cares. Even now, during the few minutes she had spent in the nursery, the English governess and Matrena Filimonovna had found time to ask some questions that could not be put off and which she alone could answer. What should the children wear when they went out? Ought they have milk? Should not a new cook be sent for? Oh, do leave me alone, she cried. And returning to her bedroom, she sat down where she had sat when talking with her husband. Locking together her thin fingers, on which her rings hung loosely, she went over in her mind the whole of their conversation. Gone. But how did he finish with her, she thought. Is it possible that he still sees her? Why didn't I ask him? No, no. It's impossible to be reunited. Even if we go on living in the same house, we are strangers. Strangers forever, she repeated, specially emphasizing that word that was so dreadful to her. And how I loved him, oh God, how I loved him. How I loved him, and don't I love him now? Don't I love him more than ever? The most terrible thing, she did not finish the thought, because Matrena Filimonovna thrust her head in at the door. Hadn't I better send for my brother, she said. After all, he can cook a dinner, or else the children will go without food till 6 o'clock, as they did yesterday. All right, I'll come and see about it in a moment. Has the milk been sent for? And Darya Alexandrovna plunged into her daily cares, and for a time drowned her grief in them. All right, there we go, another chapter done. Just having a look at the next chapter. Oh, looks like a longie. That's good. Another chapter down. Have your say about this chapter over at the subreddit. Just a quick reminder to you guys about the Patreon page, patreon.com/thehemingwaylist. You can support the podcast for as little as $1. It just helps move things, keep things going over here in podcast world. It's very much appreciated. Other than that, thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.